Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. Ewan, have you been watching White Lotus?
I haven't.
Neither have I, but apparently everyone else has, including our opinion columnist Therese Raphael. She's made a reference to it in her latest piece about the pressure on Nadeem Zahawi, Conservative Party chairman, saying that this latest unfolding scandal has a quality that's both painful to watch and impossible to ignore. She says it's a niggling revelation, unsettling the smooth veneer. Perhaps that'll be the theme of the conversations at Chequers as the cabinet's meeting there today.
Yeah, possibly awkward. Yeah, very nice piece by Therese. I think the key thing is, how long is this process going to take, this independent inquiry? These things can rumble on a long time. A cynic might say that is a part of the point of them. One thing I would say, though, today, on Thursday, is none of the newspapers have got this on their front pages. So that is good news, I think, for Nadeem Zahawi.
Yeah, true. Although the whole situation a bit less than ideal for Rishi Sunak. And something else that's been labelled not ideal is the findings of Bloomberg's analysis of the government's levelling up policy, which shows that the UK's poorer regions were falling even further behind London and the South East.
Well, our political reporter Joe Mays spoke to the minister in charge of the policy, Michael Gove, about the findings while on a busy train to Manchester.
It is concerning because it reflects some of the broader problems that we're facing as an economy overall. So people sometimes find it depressing when we return to the long economic tail of the pandemic and refer to the situation in Ukraine, because it can sometimes seem as though we're using those as an excuse for the difficulties that so many are facing. But it's impossible to understand what's happening in our economy without looking at both of those. And again, one of the particular challenges that we face is that the existing health inequalities that we had in the north have been exacerbated because of COVID, and the existing economic challenges that we had in the north have been disproportionately doubled down on by what's been happening in Ukraine. Yeah. Because again, in the north of England, you have a high proportion of jobs in manufacturing. Manufacturing is obviously more reliant on the cost of energy. And so these twin troubles have made the task of levelling up at once more challenging, but also more urgent.
The critics say that for levelling up to occur, you need a pretty massive reorientation of spending and political power with massive impetus behind it, and that the data is showing that that isn't really happening.
Oh, I think, again, the data is absolutely vital, but it's important not to look in the rearview mirror. So, again, even as we speak, we're just a couple of days away from the signing ceremony for a new mayoral deal, as I mentioned, in the northeast. At least two-thirds of the population of the north benefit from devolution deals, and we want to extend that further. If we're looking at the way in which everything from research and development to arts council spending is changing, every new Arts Council pound that's being committed in the spending review is being spent outside London and the South East.
And just in terms of thinking about last year, four secretaries of state, yourself and then two others, back to yourself, do you think that kind of upheaval in Whitehall has perhaps distracted from the project or held back decisions that might have been made? And...
Well, obviously, it's not ideal to have had some of the political turbulence that we had last year. But again, that is behind us now. And the important thing is... paraphrasing Oasis, not to look back in anger, but to instead invoke Fleetwood Mac and don't stop thinking about tomorrow.
You know, some 90s song references from there, from Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove, speaking to our reporter Joe Mays on a train to Manchester.
Sadly, no more song lyrics in our next segment. We sat down with Joe to dig into the details of what the latest update to the Bloomberg Levelling Up scorecard shows.
Yeah, so the overall picture is a stagnating, or indeed worsening, attempt to level up Britain. And we've updated our scorecard with 6 months' worth of data, bringing us up to December 2022. And as you say, overwhelming majority of the country is still falling further behind, despite that key promise from the Conservatives. And indeed, in the red wall, those seats that flipped from Labour to Conservative that really won them election, it's got even worse. Now 97% of those seats are falling further behind. It was 92% back in May. So in the areas where it matters most for Sunak, the data is just not showing any real sign of that levelling up happening.
Now, Joe, this is based on some really fascinating data, isn't it? Which, as you would expect at Bloomberg, but just remind us how you do this. What are you measuring?
So we went to the government's Levelling Up white paper, which set out 12 missions it had to, you know, close wealth disparities in the UK. And they are targeting things like pay, productivity, you know, well-being, the affordability of housing, all these different measures, which, you know, if you did make improvements, clearly your area would get better and you'd catch up with London and the South East. So we've taken those exact same metrics. We've taken the government on their own metrics and we're tracking it using government data, ONS data, the Treasury, all official sources. And we're doing this exercise of saying, okay, since 2019, when the promise was made, are you closing the gap with London and the South East, or are you falling further behind? And that's how we categorise every constituency in the UK, and that's how we build this picture.
So it does seem to be quite a big difference depending on where you look at. First of all, where have there been improvements since we last spoke to you about this?
So we've seen some modest improvements in the east of England, so seats that are already quite close to London, and also Northern Ireland has done quite well. And in terms of the areas that have fallen back, we have areas in the northwest, for example, that have struggled, and also the east and west Midlands. So I think the east of England finding is interesting because it shows that government is making progress, but these are areas that are really still quite close to the capital. So it's kind of, can you level up the whole country and not just necessarily, you know, the hinterland of London?
Yeah, the east of England is broadly a relatively prosperous region, isn't it? Although, of course, there are pockets of deprivation, as there are everywhere. I thought interesting looking at your maps, beautiful maps, actually, on the story. And interesting, you picked out the red wall seats, and barely any of them seem to be making progress. It really stands out, that.
Yeah, and I guess that's what's quite worrying for the Conservative Party and Rishi Sunak, in that there's, what, 36 of those seats. You know, if you lose all of those, you effectively lose your majority. And it was there that the levelling up promise was so keenly heard, keenly felt. And indeed, many people in many of those areas voted Brexit, indeed thought that doing so would, you know, lead to the area being revitalised. They might catch up with the London and the South East. And yeah, as our data is showing, that gap is widening.
That certainly doesn't bode well for the hope of the Conservative Party to try and retain those seats in the next election.
I mean, for sure. And you have the Conservatives at least 20 points behind Labour in most recent opinion polling. And yeah, that kind of economic picture suggests that would you necessarily vote Conservative again if your area has been left behind or continues to be left behind in that way? Yeah, it's a tough one.
What's behind the region, this massive regional divide? I don't mean the regional divide that we've seen for decades. I'm talking about the regional divide which seems to have cropped up in the last 6 months, particularly the east of England doing very well and the southwest doing very badly. It's quite stark, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, we're digging into these findings all the time. I think, you know, there's some macro effects going on, especially in the last 6 months. You know, you've had inflation, you've had the cost of living crisis, you've got Russia's war in Ukraine, pushing up energy bills and so on. So certainly the macro picture is tricky for the government, and, you know, whether you can, you know, reverse massive economic trends within your country, you know, London, the South East being the powerhouse of the UK, can you reverse those trends and share some of that prosperity around the country? It's difficult when your kind of government capacity is overwhelmed by these big issues. So that's certainly a limiting factor for Sunak.
One of the factors that you're tracking in this is government spending or public spending involved. And of course, that's the easiest lever the government has to be able to pull when it comes to boosting an area. How has the promise in terms of public spending played out in compared to the reality?
Yeah, that's been one of the most surprising features of the scorecard, in that London and the South East have seen their spend on public services grow faster than any other region in the UK. Now, you'd expect spending to be higher in London and the South East because things are more expensive, but why should the growth rate be higher? Similarly on transport funding, that's again an area where London and the South East has increased its advantage over, say, the North East compared to 2019. It's a striking figure, I think, in my mind, and you'd thought the government would change that.
Now, we've talked about this being the second iteration of this scorecard since you produced the first one back in May. Talk to us about what happened when that first scorecard went out. How did the government react, and has it actually prompted them to change anything in the way this project is being conducted?
Yeah, so the first scorecards received a fair amount of attention. I mean, multiple MPs raised it in Parliament. You know, Lisa Nandy, who's the shadow Levelling Up Secretary for Labour, she challenged the government directly on its findings. I think, if anything, it provided a kind of data framework through which you can look at levelling up. I mean, I think a lot of political focus in this country happens around what's going on in Westminster and the personalities and all the daily drama, whereas I think we're trying to bring a kind of a grounded empirical view on the whole country, on what the effects of British politics are on the whole country. And that's why we think it had that initial success, and that's why we hope to keep doing it and keep providing these updates, so that we can kind of effectively hold the government to account on their flagship promise.
Does anyone actually believe that it's possible to bridge the gap between essentially London and the South East and the rest of the country when you speak to people who are based in these areas that should be, you know, looking at the data, being helped by this?
Yeah, when I go out, say, on visits I've had to the North, there is a sense of a North-South divide, and there's a sense of, you know, London always gets everything, the South always gets everything. We're basically forgotten about up here, and that perception remains. I mean, I'm really yet to visit a town or a village in, say, the Red Wall, and people will say, yes, you know, this government's really on our side and this government's really delivering for us. I mean, I'm yet to get that compelling sense through my reporting. Obviously, Rishi Sunak hopes that will turn around before the next election.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
Now, let's talk trains. After a brief respite, we're set for another 2 days of rail strikes next week, with drivers walking out on Wednesday and Friday across much of the network.
But taking a step back, are Britain's railways in a bad state, and how do they really compare to other countries? Caroline Hepke and I spoke to Bloomberg opinion columnist Matthew Brooker. We asked him why he's written on this subject.
Well, I started out by really with the question, why are Britain's railways so not better, not nicer than they are, with quite a negative point of view. And I think as I look further into it, I decided they weren't really that bad, and you know, I shouldn't be too unfair. I mean, there are bright spots, but I think when you look at the industry as a whole, it does have significant issues and challenges.
Hmm. Hang on a second. when Ewan Potts and I tried out the new, brand new Elizabeth line, I know it's a train, it's an underground system, but when we got onto that train, you and I, we were stunned at how wonderful the new infrastructure was. Yes, it took years to make, etc. But surely the trains are in a terrible state. How do they compare country to country? Why did you come out saying that things aren't quite so awful?
Yeah, the Elizabeth line is very nice. I did go and ride it before writing this piece. I think if you've come from Asia, though, I think anyone coming from Hong Kong who sees the Elizabeth line is going to shrug with indifference, because it basically looks exactly like the MTR in Hong Kong. And in fact, it's run by the MTR in Hong Kong. They didn't build it, but they do operate the service. And yeah, you know, it's nice, big, spacious stations, wide platforms, comfortable carriages. They seem, I'm not sure if they are, but they seem bigger than your average train or underground carriage. But, you know, that's one line. I mean, you know, there's a lot more to the rail network than that. And, you know, I took the point of view, obviously I'm British, but I haven't lived here for a long time. I moved back last September after more than 30 years in Asia. And so I took, you know, tried to take the perspective of an outsider, you know, of someone who's been used to the train systems in Asia, coming here and what, you know, thinking, what would they think of them? I don't think they'd be that impressed, actually.
I do think it's a complicated picture, though, isn't it? I don't think that all the trains on the continent are fantastic. You've got some rural lines in France and they are terrible. And some lines here actually work very well. And I think it's also fair to point out that privatisation has seen a huge rise in the number of people using the railway. So it is complex, isn't it?
Oh, you know, absolutely. You know, I can remember riding the TGV in France 40 years ago and being kind of, wow, this is amazing. And, you know, by all accounts, the TGV is still like very, very nice, and it's fast and efficient. But yes, you know, the rural train system in France has really got very serious problems. And, you know, there's rising dissatisfaction in Germany, which I think we always associate with engineering prowess and efficiency. So, I was comparing mostly with Asia. I mean, the UK still doesn't look particularly good on most surveys relative to the rest of Europe. But it's not like the rest of Europe is, apart from Switzerland, is really that great. I mean, you look at there was a survey of railway efficiency in the World Economic Forum's World Competitiveness Report from 2019, I think. So it's a little bit out of date because it's obviously pre-pandemic, and pandemic has changed a lot of things. But that had the top five, only one was in Europe, and that was Switzerland. I mean, it went Japan, Hong Kong, South Korea and Singapore.
All right. So look, we've laid the groundwork then. Perhaps the UK is not an outlier within Europe, sort of struggling with the trains. But the complaint I always hear in France is that it's fine if you're going from Paris somewhere else. But actually, you know, if you're trying to get around some parts of France, then it's impossible. But look, there is an issue with privatisation. And there does seem to be a growing sort of acceptance that the privatisation of the railways in the UK has not worked. And a lot of people are kind of trying to assign blame. So just tell us what's gone wrong and why.
Yeah, I don't think this is even a debate.
Right.
Because, you can argue about privatisation, whether privatisation was right or wrong. But when the party that itself privatised the railways describes it as being, you know, dysfunctional and full of perverse incentives and unable to do the basics right, like running the trains on time, making it easy to buy a ticket, then why do you even need to argue? These are the people that decided to privatise the railways and did it in the way that they did. And they say it's a failure. So I think we can all accept that it has been a failure. I mean, they're, you know, not unmitigated failure. I mean, things have improved, as we say, and then there are parts of the rails are very nice and function quite well. But overall, the system, you know, is the way that the railways were privatised was clearly flawed.
This isn't about private sector bad, public sector good, though, is it? This is about privatisation. This is about the how can I say this without being rude, the very complicated way in which the railways were privatised in the 90s by the Tories.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating example in your piece, isn't there, about a huge number of people who are employed to assign blame when trains are late?
Yeah, something like 400, I can't remember what they call them, train delay adjudicators or something like that, and whose job, in the words of the report itself, is to argue about whose fault a delay is.
Because somebody has to pay, that's the bottom line.
Well,
somebody becomes
of course, if you had a vertically integrated structure, which would be far more rational and which is what the government is suggesting going back to, you wouldn't have an argument because, you know, if the train is late, it's the fault of the train company. At the moment, it isn't because you've got this separation between the rail infrastructure owner, Network Rail, and the, you know, multiplicity, couple of dozen train service operators. Mm.
So then, look, I can understand that rail users, and it's regularly covered, are tearing their hair out in terms of trying to get a decent service. How is this unravelled? Is there a suggestion and a pathway forwards in terms of unravelling this, as you put it, sort of disastrous privatisation?
Yeah, I mean, there is a plan. This was all in the William Shapps Rail Review that was published in 2021. And it's essentially, people deny, the government itself denies that this is going back to the old British Rail, the state-owned monopoly operator that was privatised in the early 90s. And I think, you know, even people who are in favour of renationalisation don't regard this as a recreation of British Rail, but it seems like it to me. I mean, it's going to be called Great British Railways. It's going to adopt the double arrow logo of British Rail, which is so recognisable and is, you know, still used on the rail system. And, you know, essentially it's going to be one company that owns the infrastructure and then, you know, the difference would be, I mean, instead of having franchises where, you know, different companies compete to offer services and on different parts of the railway, Great British Railways would operate a concession model where they specify the fares and the timetables and, you know, then presumably private companies will then operate those services.
Is it going to happen? That's my question. And we've come bogged down in these lengthy strikes and all sorts of other stuff. Mm. Is this going to happen before this government is out?
It looks pretty unlikely, actually, because the Conservative Party is now arguing amongst themselves about this plan. I mean, it seems that the more kind of purist free enterprise elements within the Conservatives don't like the idea of recreating this big state monolith, and so they are trying to rewrite the plan to bring back franchising, which really is at the very heart of all the dysfunction in British Rail.
Okay.
There have been reports in the British local papers, the British national press, that this is happening and that it means that, I mean, we have to have an election, I think, by early 2025.
Yes.
You know, it's only 2 years away now. Even if the revamped blueprint goes into action, it seems pretty unlikely that anything's going to happen by the time of the next general election. The opposition Labour Party is committed to renationalising the railways, and they may be in power by the time anything actually happens on this plan.
So, Matthew, in the meantime, what happens to all of us humble train riders? The ridership and the ticket prices, we're all just left hanging?
Well, you know, if you live along the Elizabeth line and commute into London, you're fine. I mean, you know...
Happy as Larry.
It all depends on where you are. But, you know, for people like me who've come back from Asia, we will at least learn in future to check the strike schedule, because, you know, what prompted me to write about this was going down to my local station and standing in the freezing rain, then looking up at the board and realised that no trains were running.
Well, that was Bloomberg opinion columnist Matthew Brooker.
Okay, well, interesting. You and I know that you have a lot of opinions on trains.
I do. I'm not going to talk about them now because it could go on for hours and hours and nobody will be listening.
Well, I mean, give us your one singular thought. What's your favourite train?
I haven't got a favourite train. I'm not that nerdy. I do think it's a fascinating subject. And I think a bit like the weather, Brits like to talk about the railways and like to moan about them a great deal. But as Matthew was saying, they're not actually that bad compared to some other railways.
I'm going to wind you up for future train knowledge in the future, but that is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so that people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you use
this. This episode was produced by James Walcock and Mariful Hussain was on sound. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.